from Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 1, Chapter 18, Text 12. Karmanyasmin anashvase Duma dumrat manam bhavan Apayayati govinda Pada padma savam madhu. Translation. We have just begun the performance of this fruitive activity, a sacrificial fire, without certainty of its result due to the many imperfections in our action. Our bodies have become black from the smoke, but we are factually pleased by the nectar of the lotus feet of the personality of Godhead, Govinda, which you are distributing. Purport by Srila Prabhupada. The sacrificial fire kindled by the sages of Naimisharanya was certainly full of smoke and doubts because of so many flaws. The first flaw is that there is an acute scarcity of expert brahmanas able to carry out such performances successfully in this age of Kali. Any discrepancy in such sacrifices spoils the whole show, and the result is uncertain, like agricultural enterprises. The good result of tilling the paddy field depends on providential rain, and therefore the result is uncertain. Similarly, performance of any kind of sacrifice in this age of Kali is also uncertain. Unscrupulous, greedy brahmanas of the age of Kali induce the innocent public to such uncertain sacrificial shows without disclosing the scriptural injunction that in the age of Kali there is no fruitful sacrificial performance but the sacrifice of the congregational chanting of the holy names of the Lord. Suta Goswami was narrating the transcendental activities of the Lord before the congregation of sages, and they were factually perceiving the result of hearing these transcendental activities. One can feel this practically as one can feel the result of eating food. Spiritual realization acts in that way. The sages of Naimisharanya were practically sufferers from the smoke of a sacrificial fire and were doubtful about the result. But by hearing from a realized person like Suta Goswami, they were fully satisfied. In the Brahma Vaivarta Purana, Vishnu tells Shiva that in the age of Kali, men full of anxieties of various kinds can vainly labor in fruitive activity and philosophical speculations. But when they are engaged in devotional service, the result is sure and certain, and there is no loss of energy. In other words, nothing can be performed for spiritual realization or for material benefit. Nothing performed for spiritual realization or for material benefit can be successful without the devotional service to the Lord. Oman jnana tamaram vasya janam jana shalakaya chakshuru militam yena tasmai shri gurave namaha shri chaitanya manovistam stapitam yena bhutale svayam rupakatamayam dadati svapadantikam. So the translation. We have just begun the performance of this fruitive activity, a sacrificial fire, without certainty of its result, due to the many imperfections in our action. Our bodies have become black from the smoke, but we are factually pleased by the nectar of the lotus feet of the personality of Godhead, Govinda, which you are distributing. So the process of devotional service is essential for spiritual advancement. It's described that there are different approaches to this idea of elevation of one's situation in life. There's the path of fruitive activity according to Vedic regulations, and then there's the path of jnana, or intellectual speculation, then there's the mystic yoga system, and there's the process of bhakti, or devotional service. And it's described that actually for all of these processes to be successful, there has to be some element of devotional service there. Nonetheless, there's a tendency of people who adhere to these other processes to decry the idea of devotional service as being somehow inferior. Actually, a key element there lies in the whole question of the inner motivation of the individual. Devotional service involves subordination to the Supreme Personality of Godhead, so one can hardly even conceive of devotional service without thinking of surrender and subordination. That's essential to the idea of devotional service. Whereas all these other processes involve the prowess of the individual as a powerful entity capable of accomplishing various goals. So therefore, this mode of thinking is complementary to the false ego of the individual. So ultimately, one can engage in these other processes in pursuance of a basic underlying desire to dominate and control, to be the superior in one's particular situation. Whereas the very idea of devotional service eliminates this concept that one is the superior. So for that reason, these other processes tend to be appealing. So the sages of Naimisharanya were engaged in a fruitive sacrifice in accordance with the Vedic principles. So the very idea of performing the sacrifice in accordance with Vedic principles indicates that there's an element of bhakti there, or devotional service, because one must ask, why perform the sacrifices in accordance with particular principles, and where are the principles coming from? So the very fact that one is accepting certain principles means that one is surrendering. One is accepting that one's own will or one's own particular personal idea may not be adequate, or in fact will not be adequate for proper pursuance of one's goals, but rather one has to accept some higher order. And of course the question then is, where does the higher order come from? And if you think about it, well, the higher order comes from the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So even if one is engaged in sacrificial performances or other karmakanda fruitive activities, still, in order to even pursue things, pursue fruitive activity in accordance with religious principles, one has to accept surrender to the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So fruitive activity which has in it no element of surrender to the Supreme Personality of Godhead is what is called vikarma, and involves very degraded activities without any regulation of the senses. Of course, even in these sacrificial activities, the ultimate goal of the sacrifice is Lord Vishnu. All of the different Vedic sacrifices, for example, the different mantras begin with Om, which is an extremely misunderstood word. Even the mantras to Shiva begin with Om, like Om Namah Shivaya and so forth. So Om refers to Vishnu. That's actually a name of Krishna. So all of these different sacrifices, in all of these different sacrifices, the mantras refer specifically to Lord Vishnu, the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So that is recognized even within this sacrificial system. So devotional service is essential there. Of course, we see that there are different modes of religious faith in which people approach God for the purpose of gaining fruitive benefits, but still they're approaching God. So the idea of surrender to the Supreme Personality of Godhead is there. Yet at the same time, people are thinking, well, I'll surrender to the Supreme Personality of Godhead in order to satisfy certain material desires. So surrender to God becomes a means to an end, and the end is actually exploitation for one's own selfish purposes. So the better conclusion would be simply to surrender to God in order to carry out whatever desires God might have. And if one comes to that conclusion, one actually can come to the point of pure devotional service. So another aspect or path of development that is pursued is this path of jnana, or intellectual development. It's described that through jnana, one can understand Krishna in his Brahman feature, ultimately. It's interesting to consider why that is so. Essentially, the process of jnana is, in the ultimate issue, negative, because it involves determining what spirit is not. So in Sanskrit, this is called neti-neti. And it's interesting to see that the same idea comes up in various parts of the world. For example, in the Christian tradition, it's called via negativa, which is the same thing, the negative way. In other words, determining what is not spiritual, and by eliminating everything that is not spiritual, you arrive at an understanding of what is spiritual. The same thing is true, I understand, in Zen Buddhism. The idea is to negate everything material. So the reason that this intellectual process proceeds in this way is that through the mundane mind and senses, one can only perceive material things. So if one is going to engage in a process of spiritual realization using the mundane mind and senses, there's nothing to do but to examine different material phenomena and reject them as being not spiritual. But of course, there's the question finally of how can you understand that something is not spiritual unless you understand what is spiritual? It would seem difficult to do that. So people proceed on the basis of an intuition of what is spiritual. That intuition seems to be fundamental within the self of the individual. So unless you accept as a premise that there is some fundamental spiritual intuition, then it's hard to see how an intellectual process of material discrimination could ever lead to a spiritual goal. So that fundamental spiritual intuition is there, but in the material state of consciousness, it's not very highly developed. So it's described that Brahman realization is ultimately the result of this intellectual process. So this process leads one to a neutral state of spiritual existence. You could compare this to coming from the negative numbers up to zero, but it doesn't lead to any understanding of the positive numbers. Also, the Brahman conception tends to be misleading in the sense that one of the things that one negates is material variety. So one comes to the conclusion that there's no such thing as spiritual variety. Variety must be a non-spiritual thing. One concludes this on the basis of looking at material variety. So the tendency is to come to the conclusion that there could be no such thing as spiritual variety. Of course, this has the drawback that one must then ask, where does the material variety come from? Philosophers will define spirit in some kind of absolute, all-comprehending form. And one might ask, by the way, where the idea of this is coming from. It would seem that there is an intuition behind this, because you see people who have no scriptural tradition also coming up with this idea. So there seems to be a basic appeal to the concept of some ultimate unified source of all reality. And different philosophers seek to understand that ultimate source. You find even Albert Einstein trying to understand this. And so Einstein was pursuing what they call a unified field theory in physics. The idea is that it's not satisfactory if you have just many different things. The ultimate source or the ultimate basis of reality must be one thing. So Einstein was seeking that, even though he was not the follower of any scriptural tradition. This intuition is there of an ultimate oneness. But if this ultimate oneness is the source of everything material, how is it that from oneness you have variety coming? This basic question is there. So if this question is addressed, one can consider the defect of the ultimate impersonal conclusion that one arrives at through this intellectual process of speculation. So it's described that people can actually come to a stage of Brahman realization through this process. Lord Chaitanya said that there are two ways in which people are becoming liberated. One is through devotional service, and the other is through this process of intellectual speculation. But those who attain liberation by that method ultimately fall down again, because they don't attain a stable spiritual situation. So Srila Prabhupada has compared that with flying into the sky in an airplane and not finding any place in the sky where one can reside or find a stable situation. So the result is one has to come down again at some point. So that's also the situation in the Brahman realization. Another aspect of this is that since the Brahman realization involves ultimately a negation of the idea of variety, without the discovery of positive spiritual variety, the inner desire of the soul for variety is not satisfied in that state, and thus one comes down to material activity again. So then another aspect of another path of development is this path of mystic yoga, which leads to realization of the Paramatma feature of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So, this essentially the idea of the mystic yoga process is to, by controlling the senses, be actually able to see the Supersoul within the heart. The idea is that we are not able to see the Supersoul because we're so much diverted by different sensory activities on the material platform. But if you're able to actually control the material senses, then it becomes possible to perceive the Supersoul. So that's the mystic yoga process. So it's described that all of these processes, in order to be successful, actually require some element of devotional service. Because ultimately, for the processes to work, the benediction of the Supreme Personality of Godhead has to be there. If Krishna is not favorably disposed to the individual who's pursuing some particular line of endeavor, then the endeavor will not be successful. So for this reason, some element of bhakti is actually necessary. So one can say then, why not simply engage in process of bhakti? Why divert oneself to engage in all these other processes of development if bhakti is actually the essence in all of them? So let us see. I must say, in reading this, I was not able to come up with any particular idea of what I should say. So, any comment or question? Maybe that will lead to something. Yeah?
Well, this seems that Prabhupada's paraphrasing the verse in the 11th canto, and Bhakti Operation of Bhava, Yudhakti Ramisha, by just as when a person is eating, I don't have it in front of me right now, he feels satisfaction.
Yes, that's what Srila Prabhupada is referring to. Yes, perhaps one can. Yeah?
You were and that even without religious systems, just like the example of Einstein's unified field, that there's an inherent idea that there should be an absolute from which all of variation emanates, or one within the source.
Yeah.
Suppose we were to counter that that's just, we are born in a world of random.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the way it works. And just like computers, or, you know, they have a tendency to form things into systems. It's a way of processing information. It's just, unless you process information, you can't function. So it's just wishful thinking. It's inherent nature in a random world to try to make order out of it. But it doesn't mean it's in order. And it doesn't mean that it's actually the soul's intuitive remembrance of being a supreme personality of Godhead. It's just a matter of the entity trying to process information and make sense out of an irrational world. But it's actually this whole idea of there being a system and a God and an order and an ultimate source. It's just wishful thinking. And it's just it's just the information processing nature of the entity.
Yeah, well, in reply to that, you can ask, why does the information processing take place? Because it's the same old argument. The reason I'm hesitating to discuss it is that I've discussed it before. But then we always discuss things again. Why should information processing take place? Computers don't program themselves. People who are involved with computers come to a realization of this. There's a tendency towards disorganization. If you let things just operate, they tend to break down, and you don't tend to find an orderly pattern emerging. Of course, this is a whole discussion, because you can get orderly patterns, for example, the pattern of frost forming on a window pane is quite orderly, and that's just happening by a physical process. So one can say, well, a physical process can produce order, but it can't produce the kind of order that you see, for example, even in computers, for example. There you see a complex pattern which is not in any way required by the underlying material circumstances. So why do such patterns develop? And why, indeed, do philosophers tend to arrive at the idea of explaining things in terms of some ultimate cause and so forth? They wouldn't have to do that. Of course, many people don't do that also. So there's the whole line of reasoning which can be pursued along those lines. It's known as the argument for design. One can go into that. So that amounts to an argument for a variegated spiritual source. So that whole line of argument can be looked at. So, yes, Srila Prabhupada is referring here to practical spiritual realization as opposed to different intellectual processes. It's described that when one attains actual realization of through bhakti yoga, one is not interested in the intellectual practices of realization and so forth. Of course, all realization of whatever it may be is of the same nature. Ultimately, you see, the comment will be made, mysticism is something ineffable. It involves ineffable states of consciousness, things that you can't describe. People who criticize the idea of mysticism will always refer to this. However, anything that one experiences is ultimately not describable. You can only describe your experience to another person if the other person has had similar experience. And somehow or other, words exist in which there's a mutual understanding. This itself is a great mystery. For example, can you explain what it means to see a sunset? Could you explain that to a person who is blind from birth? What it's like to experience a sunset? So the experience is just actually known. So similarly, the result of bhakti yoga ultimately is a matter of experience. And persons on the platform of devotional service can understand that experience whereas those who are not on that platform cannot understand it. Ultimately, you can't convey it to someone who doesn't have the experience, but there's nothing unusual about that because you couldn't convey even knowledge of the sunset to someone who was unable to see. So ultimately, the process of communicating bhakti yoga is to instruct people in how to engage in certain practices in which the same experience will be awakened within them, so that they can also have the direct realization. So the whole framework of the Vedic literature provides a system whereby one is able to come to direct realization of one's relationship with Krishna. So, other comment? Yeah?
I have a question and a comment.
Yeah.
Like Dhruva Maharaj, he was forming fear of fairness, but then ultimately understood that his bhakti yoga was higher. That was that his realization at the end. Krishna appeared before him. He was here for him to change his process from that point on, or is it considered devotional service? That was recommended
for us
at that time.
Well, Dhruva Maharaj was engaging in devotional service for a very strong material desire. That can be done, and it's described that whatever your motives, whether you have desire for material activities or liberation, or you're free of desire, it's a good idea to engage in devotional service. So in the case of Dhruva Maharaj, he had this rather intense desire to, essentially, he had been insulted. His karmic situation was that he had extreme pride as a kshatriya. And so he'd been greatly insulted by his stepmother, not allowed to get on his father's lap and so forth. So he wanted to acquire this kingdom very intensely. So he was engaged in devotional service for that purpose by Narada Muni. So he was performing these very extreme austerities, which are practically inconceivable, or physically impossible, actually. So for us. But then you have to consider that he was the grandson of Brahma. So if your grandfather is Brahma, these things are probably easier than if you're a few more generations removed and living in the Kali Yuga. But when Lord Vishnu actually appeared before him, at that point, he realized the actual nature of bhakti, because he actually saw Lord Vishnu. This, of course, raises an interesting question. Previously, he was meditating on the form of Lord Vishnu. He'd actually made deity forms. That was one part of Narada Muni's instruction. But then when he was just meditating, he was meditating on the form of Lord Vishnu. But there seemed to be a difference when he actually saw Lord Vishnu. But if the form of Lord Vishnu on which he was meditating was non-different from Lord Vishnu, then what is the difference? Anyway, I could raise that question. Yeah, you had... Yeah.
Because that argument is put forward to the Mayavadis in India, and they have a way to explain that. The way they have the bottom of the Bhagavad Gita comes from nothing. The way they picture it is that just like a seed, you plant the seed in the ground, and from there you have all this tremendous amount of Bhagavad Gita, seeds, trees, fruits, flowers, all that come from nothing, just a seed. That is there.
Well, the answer is the seed. You may think it's nothing because your senses are so blunt, but the seed contains, if you look, say, at modern biochemistry, here's where biochemistry can come to the rescue. You look within the seed and you examine the DNA and the different chemical structures there, you find the seed is extremely complicated. And the modern idea is the seed contains programming that produces the whole tree. So the tree is actually, so to speak, stored up within the seed. It's not that something is coming out of nothing. It's just that something large, so that you can see it, is coming out of something that is small, which you can't see. So, but it's not that you have really more variegatedness than you had before. All the different patterns of the twigs, the fruits, the leaves, and so on, are coded in the DNA. So one can ask, well, where did the coding come from? One has to explain that. So that's not a very good answer. The Mayavadis will have to go back and try again, yeah? Yeah, they're reproductions of the same image, too, as you can see. Well, you do find that in the material world. That's what reproduction is. You make many copies of the same bodies over and over again, combining the different features. So, in the material world, you have reproduction of these different patterns. You can mix them together and produce different combinations. But the question is, where does the original information come from? If you say it's eternally there in the material world, you have a problem, because there's a tendency of destruction in the material world. So how can order eternally exist in a setting where a continual process of destruction is going on? This is a problem. If you say it's been there for infinity, for an infinite amount of time, and if it's not eternally in the material world, then where does it come from? It has to come from somewhere other than the material world. So, and then what do you mean by material? If by material you mean everything which can be understood more or less mechanically, then that means that what it comes from, if that is non-material, must be something that you can't understand mechanically. That argument can be made. So what is it? Well, we're following the Gyani process here. Since that process doesn't directly tell you, and you don't know what it is, but whatever it is, it's not mechanical, and it has it's a source of information. So what is that? One comes to the conclusion there must be such a thing, but what is it? So, let's see. Yeah? Which question?
I have another question.
Okay.
Just so they can hear better.
Okay, right.
But if it's something you can't understand materially,
yeah,
then isn't it from the word go? Don't Gyanis just across the logic understand it? How can they, where are they going to go? I mean, you can only go so far with your material mind. And if the nature of the material world is that everything is has a tendency to destruct or wear down or become lost, then these information codes, like you say, has to be coming from something that's beyond the material nature, something that's eternally existing. And if all we're using is our material mind and material experience and material understandings, then we're going to only go to the extent of the material nature, and what have we accomplished? Isn't that inherent in the process?
Well, that's exactly the problem with the process of Jnana, namely that one ultimately concludes there's something beyond the material domain, but one cannot come to any positive appreciation of that by the material intellectual process. So then where does that leave you? If you actually engage in the austerity required to then, instead of just speculating about it, to actually separate your mode of existence from the material continuum, that's what you could call practical jnana as opposed to mere theoretical jnana. On the theoretical side, you just do what scholars do. You indulge your senses like anything, while at the same time engaging in different speculations. So that leads to nothing but publications. It increases the volume of libraries. But if you engage in what you could call the practical jnana process, then you say, well, if this is material, and for some reason I think this is not desirable, and then one can ask, well, where does that idea come from also? Why does one think that? But if one does so, then one ultimately comes to a neutral state where one isn't interacting with the material things, but there's no positive spiritual life either. So one has managed to come to zero. So ultimately it's not satisfactory. Of course, there are different ideas of Brahman. The Mayavadi idea of Brahman refers to something non-existent. In other words, there is no such thing as the Mayavadi concept of Brahman. The actual Brahman, which is the effulgence of Krishna, is in itself variegated, for one thing, because, after all, it's coming from Krishna. So it must be a variegated reality. So, yeah?
On that point of, in Kali Yuga, it's very difficult to perform sacrifices, does that also apply to, for example, demigod worship, actually properly worship them to get certain effects, or at least it's very difficult?
That's precisely what it does apply to. Because all of these fruitive sacrifices were basically, I should repeat the question, does the difficulty of performing sacrifice in Kali Yuga refer to demigod worship? So basically that's what it refers to, because these different sacrifices were directed towards different demigods, basically. Essentially, one doesn't directly approach Lord Vishnu for fruitive results, actually. One approaches different demigods. So that's the kind of thing that is difficult in Kali Yuga. For that reason, it's interesting, you'll see that religion in the mode of ignorance is very much flourishing in the Kali Yuga. That's going on like anything. But worship of demigods according to proper regulations is not a very common thing at the present time. Although, of course, it still goes on. But it's more difficult, yeah? Yeah, people take to what corresponds to their modes. So, in any case, any other question or comment? Chala Gorj to Srila Prabhupada.
One question. Are you against the whole idea of intuition? Intuition sometimes describes just a you require a certain amount of data, and in your brain, somewhere in the back of your brain, just accumulates and is processing this data, and then all of a sudden, boom, wow, there's an answer that makes sense. I mean, that's the way it's been described to me before, it's about intuition, or the eureka phenomena.
Yeah, well, the question is, why do you see such uniformity in the existence of certain intuitions? How is it that people have an idea of a higher spiritual reality which is has oneness? Why oneness?
Maybe that's the reality. And it's just that by your brain analyzing and just goes, oh, wow, spits out that answer. Wonderful.
Yeah, but the point is, how is it that that comes about? Because looking at nature, looking around and seeing things, what do you see with your senses or perceive with your senses which indicates that there's one unified reality? Because you see a what they call a blooming, buzzing confusion, right? Mm-hmm. If you just look around, there's just all kinds of things going on. Why not adopt pure polytheism?
Right.
Of course, they will, you know, one standard thing that you'll read in history books is that, well, people were polytheistic and then they became monotheistic. But actually, if you look at it, the history of religions and so forth, you'll find that wherever there appears to be pure polytheism, there's actually an underlying monistic philosophy existing. That was true of the Greeks even.
Mm-hmm.
They had their monistic ideas also. Aristotle was teaching about a sort of Mayavadi monistic concept of God as actus purus, which pure actuality without any change or transformation. It's very much like Brahman and so forth. So where do people come up, how is it they come up with that? Because you would think that if the sense data was flowing in and the computer back there was just grinding away and processing it, it would not come up with a conclusion like that.
This is just a commonality between the things that are living. I mean, there's
mm-hmm.
these things that are living are born, they grow old, and die.
Sure, but what?
But all the things, no matter how varied they are, all living things do this.
So what?
There's a big commonality right there.
There's commonality, and the air is the same wherever you go, and water is the same, and flesh is the same, whether you
okay. fat. Yeah, there's proteins are proteins are proteins.
Sure, and sunlight is basically
carbon's
the same.
Carbon's carbon.
But air is different from flesh. And behavior of volcanoes is different from that of amoebas. So where's the commonality? So why philosophy anyway? Why does philosophizing take place?
Well, nature isn't human to philosophize.
Right. Where does it come from? So they can always
big, incredibly huge brains. We got to do something with them.
Yeah, well, porpoises have big brains too.
And they may philosophize, you know.
Well,
some people believe they do, you know.
Yeah, right. So, yeah, well, the question can still be raised. I mean, one can always wave one's hands and say an unknown evolutionary process produces this. But still, the question can be raised as to why people tend to uniformly come up with the same kinds of mystical ideas and report the same kinds of mystical experiences also. So the explanation might be that there's some non-sensory inputs that have a commonality. And that's what they're reporting.
Yeah.
So, one can consider that.
Thank you.